of the Southern Baptist Home Mission Board. Through his editorial efforts and leadership, the magazine Home Missions has become a vital instrument in awakening Southern Baptists to their social and moral responsibilities. There's a story from Arkansas. It says, several years ago, a guy was reading a Playboy. Someone came in, he covered it up with the Home Missions magazine. Now, if he's caught reading the Home Missions magazine, he covers it up with his Playboy. We're glad to have Walker Knight here to talk about On Becoming Human through the press.
I usually feel like apologizing after being introduced to anyone because the usual comment is, you're not at all like what I expected. And I'm sorry that I'm not 6'4" and 250 pounds and old and gray. I just seem to write that way. And then the comment follows how much they appreciate the magazine, especially the last 2 or 3 years. Before that, they didn't read it. The only problem is I've been editor of it for 10 years. It was 3 or 4 years ago that I got some excellent assistance in the form of Dallas Lee and Don Rutledge, and a lot of credit that I get belongs to them. And then they always want to inquire about my circulation. Well, all I'd like to say is that at the rate I'm going, I may be out of a job in 15 years. When we were editing the magazine, I guess we had in mind the leadership sector of our churches, pastors, and lay leadership. The amazing thing has happened. Another strange way that I have of succeeding is that we seem to have hit the students and the young adults. Well, this pleases me because I feel it's an investment in the future. And I hope that one attraction has been some recognition of an attempt for integrity within the publication. I'd like to share with you as a newsman some rather encouraging news that occurred last night and is occurring right now. Our missionaries, Herbert Cottle and David Feit, who have been imprisoned in Cuba since 1965, April of 1965. You may have heard they were released from prison last month, and last night they reached Brownville, Texas at 6 o'clock. And at this time, probably right now, they are being interviewed by the press at the Atlanta airport. David and his wife and their children, Dr. and Mrs. Cottle, have all returned to the United States. So I know you rejoice with me, especially since David is a graduate of Southeastern, and many of you know him personally. I believe an insatiable desire to be more than human appears to be basic to man's nature. From the earliest account, he pridefully desires godlike knowledge of good and evil, and from that fallen moment, his quest is a restless search for a further extension of his senses and a pushing back of his limitations. Through history, we see him picking up the stick to reach the fruit beyond. He carves out the wheel and moves into the industrial age. He creates a bow with which to propel his arrow, and the world wars fall. He draws pictures to aid his memory, and history begins. He creates the lever and the fulcrum and moves the mountain. He lights a fire and makes the city. He develops a telescope and discovers a way to the moon. What a creature we have in man, still searching for godlike powers. Through writing in the printing press, he seeks to remember all things. Through radio, he seeks to speak and to hear anything from anywhere. Through TV and global satellites, he monitors the world. gaining the ability to see all things, to show himself to all people. Through jet and the promise of even faster transportation, he races the sun around the earth and strives for the ability to be anywhere at any moment. Through the computer, he thinks of all things past and present and projects his existence into the future. Through the harnessing of nuclear power, he becomes all-powerful, able to destroy all life, if not eventually the earth himself. Man, is he still a man? He's gaining a measure of omnipotence, of omniscience, of omnipresence, of eminence, if not of transcendence. Could it be possible that soon he will see all things, hear all things, be anywhere, and possess all power and all knowledge, even the secret of life itself? Call him man? Are these not the attributes we give to God? When primitive man spoke of God, he hardly conceived of greater knowledge or vision or power or ability than man now holds. The God of primitive man was but a man with these attributes. Was it a realization of what is taking place in this extension of man's senses, this pushing back of our limitations, which led Bonhoeffer to write of a world come of age? For man can now explain most of the world, and he can do things without resorting to God. Peter Ustinov, one of my favorite people, and incidentally, he's now a rector in Scotland, in a rather negative reaction to what's taking place, wrote in the Center magazine last month. He said the world used to be a place of unanswered questions and consequently a place of poetry. Man stood under an infinity of sky, minute, naked to his enemies and to the elements, believing in the gods, or in God, who represented the colossal question mark of his existence, and asking why in music and words and dance. Soon the world will be a place of answers without questions, and already the most sophisticated computers shower us with answers to questions so complicated that only another computer can ask them. Without questions, there is no music, no dance. There are no words. A world without questions is the death knell of God, ultimately of man. Now, Ustinov is not the first to say that God is dead or is expected to die. And many claim Bonhoeffer for their cause, since he wrote that God is teaching us that we must live as men who can get along very well without him. I believe they emphasize the wrong portion of that statement. The emphasis should be upon how we live, not upon the absence of God. For is this not what we as wise parents try to teach our children? How to live responsibly without the direction of either parent, to internalize. There is a reason for pessimism today, for many see with Lewis Mumford that the Western world is caught up in a technological dynamism which is profoundly hostile to life. This generation lives at a hinge of history which will decide whether or not we push toward a greater extension of our senses to the neglect of the more humane characteristics. The major point is that we have technical achievements galore, but then these are but the instruments with which to diffuse the message, not the message itself. To be human through the press, and the press is a technical achievement, means that we must be aware of today's problems and of those forces which would make us less than human. The peculiar problem of our age is that the same achievements that have led man to exalt in his own powers have also threatened his personal being and his integrity. It is a paradox that as we seek to be more than human technologically, we often become less than human morally and spiritually. And even now, a Harvard scientist is asking other scientists to strike in protest of the misuse of technology. Now, writing in the printing press, these were among the first of man's extension of his senses. This was his ability to preserve history and the extension of his ability to communicate. Now, my attachment to the press may date me, tying me to a medium which is slowly passing, giving way to the radio, to the tape recorder, to video tapes and TV and satellites and to microfilm and to other more interesting ways of communicating. Well, certainly the press finds its role changing in relation to these newer extensions of man's senses. In fact, one of the major historical tendencies taking place today, according to Robert Lipton of Yale, is the flooding of imagery. This constant, overwhelming impact upon our minds of imagery, produced by the extraordinary flow of cultural influences over our mass communications networks, even across national boundaries. Each individual is touched by everything, but at the same time, we are overwhelmed by superficial messages and undigested cultural elements, by headlines and endless partial alternatives in every sphere of life. We appear to be drowning in this flood of imagery as we strive for a saturation point with the eye and the ear and the mind and the soul, with our emotions. And the flood threatens to engulf. Composer John Gage stated that nowadays everything happens at once, and our souls are conveniently electronic, omni-attentive. That omni-attentive, that's McLuhan-like, isn't it? And it's almost as though we're back talking about our drive to be godlike, to be omni-attentive, to hear everything at the same time. It's this sense of contemporary man as having the capacity to receive and take in everything. And in attending, as in being, nothing is off limits. We soon realize that this flooding of imagery, which we're unable to sort and assemble within meaningful ways, has made the medium as important as the message. And the massaging medium has in fact become the message. Now, this sounds like a contradiction, for earlier we said that these technical achievements were not the message, only means to diffuse the message. However, what has taken place is that we are substituting them for the message. And consequently, everything appears to be losing its meaning. Paul Tillich tells us that ancient man knew the anxiety of fate and death. For medieval man, it was the anxiety of guilt and condemnation. Modern man experiences the anxiety of meaninglessness. To this flooding of imagery, which proves to be meaningless, modern man reacts with a profound sense of absurdity and mockery. He puts everybody on, even himself. Everything he touches, he mocks. His favorite TV show is Laugh In, and his favorite comedian singer is Tiny Tim. Do you remember in the Beatle movie, A Hard Day's Night, a reporter asked Ringo, which of two gangs did he identify with? Was he a mob or a rocker? And Ringo replied, neither. I'm a mocker. Yet the hunger for a strong ideology haunts modern man. He is starved for ideas and feelings that give coherence to the world. But here too his leaning is toward new combinations. Religious movements, according to Lifton, may have less difficulty convincing modern man, but not for any length of time can they claim his allegiance. In my day and previously, man made maybe one significant shift in his direction in life and allegiance during his lifetime, but now they're telling us it's rather common to see four or five such significant shifts take place. But I wonder if we have not overlooked something significant. When man thinks and speaks of God, he uses the terms of omnipotence and omniscience and omnipresence, of immanence and of transcendence. But with what terms does God speak of God? What does God say about himself? Why have we limited our quest to be godlike to those qualities that man ascribes to God and not to those qualities that God ascribes to himself? What does Christ in his humanity show us? Did not Christ seek to characterize God as Father, a Father who loves us, who cares for us? Does not Christ give us the example of servanthood and show us that he willingly chose the path of suffering in faithfulness to God's will? Do we not need to re-examine Christ's life and what he shows us in his humanity instead of our searching to know God in all of these transcendental qualities? Let us search for godlike qualities of the spirit and character with the same drive that we have given to these technical achievements, and we just might achieve not deity but authentic humanity, and we just might become human even in the press. Now, which of all the qualities of God become man should we select for emphasis at this time in history for our secular, urban, technological world, for our time of being? Robert Theobald, the economist, who quite often speaks to church groups, has repeatedly insisted that the essential qualities mandatory in assuring a human future are bound up with the religious values of honesty, responsibility, humility, and love. Now, immediately you can find these as strong attributes of Christ. And I believe that the cultivation of these qualities will enable us to be human through the press, and your personal cultivation of these qualities will enable you to make a contribution to the future. Now, you would think that the cultivation of honesty would be no problem for a Christian publication. It is true that editors are almost never asked to lie, but they are requested to tell less than all the truth. Avoid controversy, we're told. Stress the positive. Tell the good things that God's people are doing. Now, those who make such requests are sincere, well-meaning Christians who often feel that honest, full reporting will destroy the very thing that we're seeking to achieve. The interesting aspect of such thinking is that each of these individuals feels that he should have access to all the facts, pro and con. It's just the other person who should not have all the facts. One-sided positive reporting assumes that the readership is not mature enough to accept all the truth, that they do not have the ability to make their own decisions, and that we must protect them from the reality of life, not to mention the fact that such reporting asks less than integrity from the reporter. A human future demands that we correctly gather the available information about our society and about ourselves, and that we share this information with all who must be involved in the decisions about the future. Now, since ours is a democracy, both our nation and our denomination, all of us are involved in making these decisions, so we're told. So all of us should have all of the facts. Honesty must also prompt us to the admission that we do not have the last word, or may even possibly the first word. But if we are to have a human future, we must establish or continue the tradition of the free church, of the open mind, and of mutual respect. And this is gravely in danger today, especially with Southern Baptists. Awareness is a constant, honest search for what society is like right now. And maybe you're called the now generation. But you will face the same problem that your fathers and those of us with our that are the leaders within the denomination are facing right now. Because awareness must be a constant, eternal search. You cannot stop, because once you stop in your awareness, you tend to relate to society as it was when you stopped searching, when you stopped accumulating the answers. And you provide answers, yesterday's answers, for today's problems and questions. And this is where we are as a denomination, a rurally oriented frontier heritage is trying to give the answers relevant to that time, to an urban, secular, technological world. And this is the reason that we must not only search for awareness, but never feel that we have achieved awareness. Difficult for me to express the appreciation that I have for a letter now on my desk, which said that Home Missions helps us live honestly and freely, and gives us hope that the Holy Spirit may continue to be able to use Southern Baptists. Now, if we have correctly gathered information about our world and ourselves, we are then in the position to act responsibly, to make the necessary decisions about our future. We are uniquely human when we are engaged in the decision-making process. And the press fulfills one of its best functions when it provides you with information on which to make responsible decisions, when it tells it like it is, not as we might wish it to be. Arthur Barron says, "We usually do not want to look at life the way it is, but the way the weakest part of our natures would like it to be." What he's saying is that we find it difficult to be strong enough to face reality. I think this is borne out by many of our subscribers who feel that by canceling their subscription, they can somehow shove aside reality. Our concern is not simply a smooth-running social order, but it is the development of human persons. If one can retreat from personal responsibility to immutable laws or to established customs, he can avoid making his own decisions, and hence the full dimensions of being a person. Christians are not molded by a set pattern, but are set free to be the new creation in Christ with an integrity of heart and act. In fact, Emerson said, "Whoso would be a man must be a nonconformist." And Harvey Cox has helped us to see that man's original sin included his refusal to accept responsibility. More than the prideful desire to be like God was the refusal to be a responsible man. He says that we must look at the whole first section of Genesis, not just at Adam and Eve, but at Cain and Abel, at Noah, at the Tower of Babel, because these show the way that man abdicates his living with his fellow man, is searching and looking for a way out. Now, the rule by which a reporter in a publication should be judged is on a responsible handling of the truth. Is the picture that we're presenting an accurate one, or is it distorted? But the position of truth still does not absolve me as a communicator from responsibility. And this is the agony of television today, when immediate, truthful communication of a riot spreads a disorder by inflaming others. But our tendency is really to shun responsibility. And the most insidious way that our denomination and our churches and maybe you and I personally shun our responsibility is in trying to give it to committees, to trying to pass it to the larger group. And we get involved in a bureaucracy that somehow makes a decision by achieving consensus, and we abdicate our own responsibility. If the Home Mission Board, and many say today that it is bringing fresh hope of new life to our denomination, if it is doing this, I would say it's because our executive secretary is operating on the principle that responsibility belongs at the lowest level, and that things are not passed up and up and up, but they are made and they are given to individuals, and individuals are free to be responsible. Because I am not given responsibility unless I am given the opportunity of failing. And he has not given me responsibility and freedom unless he gives me the power to actually hurt him. And this is what God has given us. This is the kind of freedom and responsibility that is ours and which we, for the most part, appear to be abdicating. Well, this leads us rather quickly to the point of humility, which includes a recognition of the inherent limitations of our medium. Architect Faxiotis warns us of relying on one-way telecommunications and transmissions of news. He tells of the capital city, and it's evidently in a South American country, in which every house in a large slum area had a television antenna. When the revolution started, the first people to come out in the streets were the inhabitants of the slums. And then came another revolution against the first, and again the same slum people were for the new revolution, and so with the next revolution. Why, he asked, well, the people, instead of operating as free people, received instructions from the television network. It's dangerous to rely on one-way communication. If we use these new type communications, we must always make sure that we are not losing person-to-person communication. Theobald warns us that the churches have been guilty of propaganda. Too little attempt to listen and too much time spent in telling others what to believe and how to act. The healthiest thing that occurred here in this conference was the black man's willingness to get up and express what he felt. Because too long the communication has been one way. But then as you heard the dialogue going on over there, you found that here was a white man trying to interpret for the Negro. And Southern Baptists are in the position of still not listening to the Negro. And we have insisted and insisted at our agency, some of us, that we engage in dialogue, but it still is not taking place. Someone is still interpreting, the Southern Baptist, the Negro. We have one-way communication. I believe this is one of the roles for the letters to the editor. And if you read the magazine, you know this is the most widely read section of our publication. Because it does really open up, and this is what we want it to do. We want it to provide two-way communication. And I constantly resist the temptation to answer the letters on the letters page. I believe the person has a right to be heard without the editor having the last word. Of course, it's a little difficult to resist sometimes, but I have learned that later letters usually answer the earlier letters. The press aids us, I believe, in becoming human when it resists this impulse to propagandize. When it resists treating us as children, subhuman. However, I'd be the first to admit that most strong and interesting people, and I believe editors are people, have a bias. And we cannot edit our publications without revealing our bias. I must admit that this is always present. But I believe that we can neither be complacent toward ourselves nor caustic toward our critics. But we must cultivate two-way communication, an openness of mind and spirit, which both makes it possible to learn and makes it possible for others to change. If I've learned anything being a member of my church, which is in a transitional community and which has successfully been able to establish a witness of integrity to all people, it is that we have been able to lead people who once were very rabid segregationists to change. We did not do it by one-way preaching or communication, but it occurred in loving dialogue as we allowed them to verbalize their feelings, but as they had to throw it against what the gospel said and against the lies that others were living. Now, Luther told the story of the mountain goats who often came face to face on sheer cliffs where they could not turn around or back up. They seemingly had reached an impossible situation as here they were at butting heads. But what always happened was that one of the goats would lay down and allow the other to walk over him. Well, maybe we haven't quite come to that confrontation, and we will find it difficult to lay down. I don't know which one's going to do the walking. But we should strive for this humility of spirit. Well, maybe it's an easy and natural step, if we have achieved humility, to move to love, which is both a quality of our lives and the content of our message. Love provides us with the capacity to adjust to the unusual circumstances of that human future that we desire. And there will be and there is much of the unusual in our future. What if through technology I can see all things, but I see no one thing to which to relate? What if I hear all things, but I hear not one thing in which there's beauty? What if I go everywhere, but I find that I am not at peace and not at home in any one place? What if I think all thoughts, but I find no satisfying answer? What if I have all power, but I have no love. I may be able to speak the languages of men and even of angels, but if I have not love, my speech is no more than a noisy gong or a clanging bell. I may have the gift of inspired preaching. I may have all knowledge and understand all secrets. I may have all faith needed to move mountains. But if I have not love, I am nothing. I may give everything I have and even give up my body to be burned. But if I have not love, it does me no good. We should love God enough that we will not be willing to be unfaithful ourselves. And we should love man enough that we will not allow others to continue in unfaithfulness without a warning. I've come to prize a poem by Yevtushenko, the Russian poet. And he says in this, "You're a brave man, they tell me. I'm not. Courage has never been my quality. Only I thought it disproportionate to so degrade myself as others did. And now they press to tell me I'm brave. How sharply our children will be ashamed, taking at last their vengeance for these horrors, remembering how in so strange a time, common integrity could look like courage." A pronounced human characteristic of Christ was his willingness to serve others. And this was part of the radical nature of his life. Dick Gregory said, "I became involved when I stopped and realized that male animals are put on earth to reproduce, but that man was put here to make this place better for other men. I made my decision to be a man." Now, in these mocking, often absurd times, many ridicule our faith, and even more are indifferent. You may remember Thomas Carlyle suggested that if Jesus returned, he would not be crucified, but he would be politely ignored. And Stuttered Kennedy, the poet preacher, picked up the thought in his often quoted poem, "They simply passed him by. They never heard a hair on his, they only let him die. For men had grown more tender, and they would not give him pain, or they only just passed down the street and they left him in the rain. Still Jesus cried, 'Forgive them, for they know not what they do.' And still it rained a winter rain that drenched him through and through. The crowds went home and left the streets without a soul to see, and Jesus crouched against a wall and cried for Calvary." Heard that poem read twice recently by leaders in Southern Baptists, and it's an excellent example of how good minds can lapse into both an incorrect assessment of man and an incorrect assessment of Christ. That poem does not picture the Christ that I know, and it does not reflect man as I see him living today. If you think that the world can be indifferent to the radical life, then you've missed the headlines of recent history, of Mahatma Gandhi, of John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, and of Martin Luther King. The world can only be indifferent to the indifferently lived life. Christ returned today, he would still be crucified, because he would so live that men would have to try to obliterate him, because he would show us what we are not. So we want to strive for honesty, correct gathering, and a correct awareness of our world. We want responsibility, a willingness to shoulder our responsibility to make the decisions that we must make with integrity. And yet it must be done in humility, recognizing our limitations. And then we must strive for love, this ability to be flexible. So whatever the situation has changed to become. But all of it, I believe, calls us to this commitment to live the radical life, to be God's person, to be the man for others. I don't know if you saw the movie, it was on TV this past week, Mirage. Gregory Peck was playing this, and the movie climaxes in a scene to where another person has a gun in his hand. And he must choose between Gregory Peck and a man called the Major. And he's wavering. And Gregory Peck comes through with these words. Thomason, commit, or you're just taking up space.
Up here, the celebration work group 4 meet up here.